listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about the 100 best works of writing written by African-American women and the impact their work has had on our society today. Now, there are a lot of challenges in parenting young children, even in the best of circumstances. And for moms who are incarcerated, it can feel impossible to play a meaningful role in your kids' lives. One program is trying to help those kids to have some normal, fun childhood experiences and to make sure they have a chance to interact with their moms outside of just visiting hours at Techeeta Prison in Fond du Lac. Kenzie Gonzalez has been working for Hometown Heroes, Inc. since 2017. She was brought on in part to help launch Camp Reunite. She has a master's in public health from the George Washington University. Kenzie, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
And Sarah Cooper is a warden for the Wisconsin Women's Correctional System, which includes Techeeta Correctional Institution in Fond du Lac. Warden Cooper, thanks so much for joining us today.
Good afternoon. It's my pleasure.
Well, Warden Cooper, let's get a quick profile of the women incarcerated at Techeeta. How many inmates are there?
So at Techeeta, we have about 920 women who are living there right now.
And I've heard that social connections, being able to connect with family members, things like that, can be a big part of hopes for rehabilitation for inmates. How important is that?
It's incredibly important. For our women who are releasing out into the community, they often have their children the day that they're released from prison. So giving them this opportunity to bond with their kids and get to know their kids on a more intimate level is incredibly important.
Now, Kenzie, tell us what Camp Reunite is. How does it work?
Yeah, so Camp Reunite, it's a week-long program. It's a trauma-informed summer camp for youth ages 8 to 15, and it's at no charge to the families. So all of the children who come to camp have a parent currently incarcerated in the Wisconsin correctional system. We launched in 2018 at Techeeta Correctional, so all of the children that we served have a mother incarcerated at Techeeta, and in the future, we actually are expanding to serve children with incarcerated fathers, and we'll start with Kettle Moraine Correctional, and so it's a really phenomenal program. We take the kids, they come to camp, they get the traditional camp experience, but in addition to that recreation time, we also do mental health promotion type activities, give them a space to meet other kids and talk to others in the same situation, and then come to Techeeta twice throughout the week to have a very extended child-friendly visit with their mothers.
And you mentioned something there, Kenzie, that seems really important for these kids in their school days, day-to-day. They might be the only kid in a classroom with an incarcerated parent or one of very few. How important is it to realize they're not alone?
Right. It's extremely important. And to date, we don't know of too many other programs out there exactly like ours. The community around parental incarceration, I think, is starting to build. But it's very important. There's over 2 million children in the U.S. that are facing this, and an estimated 88,000 in Wisconsin alone. So they're not alone, but oftentimes can feel so because there's a lot of stigma around incarceration in general. And so it's not something that kids always will want to share with others or feel like they have a space to do that. So that's what we try to create.
And Warden Cooper, what does it mean for the moms to be able to participate in these programs themselves?
For the moms, it is, it's like a lifesaver for the moms. You know, they say to us that they will do anything to make sure that they can continue to participate and that their kids can continue to participate. And what we've heard from the moms is that this time with their children really solidifies in their mind the importance of getting back out into the community and living a crime-free life and staying away from any of the addictions or any of those types of things that got them in trouble in the first place. It really just, it's a big motivation for them.
I want to give a listen to one of the moms. This is a woman named Kiana. This is from Fox 11 News in Green Bay.
I've been here for 6 months. It's kind of hard being away from my kids every day because I'm used to being with them every day and taking care of them full time. It was really exciting. I was excited to see them and they were happy. This is their first year ever going to a camp. And I always wanted to send them to a summer camp, but I wasn't able to because it was too expensive. So I am very grateful of this opportunity.
That's one of the moms. Now, Kenzie, can you tell us the kind of response you've gotten from kids who participate in Camp Reunite?
Oh, incredible experiences. amazing children. They're just very resilient. And oftentimes it's their first time away from home for an extended time when they come to Camp Reunite. So at first they may be a little shy or hesitant, but over just the course of 1 week, to see them open up so much and just bond with other children and our counselors and staff is phenomenal. And we've really seen some major changes. We've now had four sessions of Camp Reunite, and many of the kids have been able to return all four times. So from start to finish, they've just come so far.
I want to give a listen now to one of the kids. This is Kavan. Also, this is from Fox 11 News in Green Bay.
It gives them an opportunity to meet other friends that are in a situation like them, and they can speak their feelings with the other children, not just keep a secret from the people at school.
So, Warden Cooper, we heard Kenzie mention there aren't a lot of things like this around the country. Are you hoping that we can have more opportunities for moms in prisons to be part of their kids' lives and hopefully as an inspiration to not return to prison later?
Absolutely. I know that the Hometown Heroes folks have a vision that this program roll out nationwide. So anything that we can do to help get the word out, I think, is very important because this is so impactful for both the kids and the mom.
And Kenzie, you mentioned this is starting with a women's prison here. You're expanding into a men's prison. What do you see for growth beyond that?
So beyond that, well, in 2020, we will be doing the men's camp. And then beyond that, each year, I think we're just looking for partners that are willing across the U.S. really to link arms with us and expand, and always looking for ways to do that. So and then of course, funding and other partners to come about. There's so many opportunities to get involved and volunteer or work with us, whether you have a fundraising background, social work, advocacy, just spreading the word about what we're doing and really making the issue known.
And Warden Cooper, it's probably too soon to have a lot of hard data here, but what are your hopes for the impact of a program like this?
Well, we've already seen a positive impact with the ladies that have participated. Their behavior just inside of prison has greatly improved. And as I stated earlier, it really has solidified their resolve to be successful when they release. And what I hope for the ladies and for the kids, that this program gives them that opportunity to just reinforce to each other how much they mean to each other, so that together, as moms and kids, they move forward in life in a positive direction.
We'll keep watching this program. Warden Cooper, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And Kenzie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Kenzie Gonzalez with Hometown Heroes, Inc. She was brought on in part to help the program we've been talking about, Camp Reunite, a summer camp for kids whose parents have been incarcerated. Sarah Cooper was also with us, warden for the Wisconsin Women's Correctional System, which includes Tichita Correctional Institution and Fond du Lac. They were both with us to talk about this Camp Reunite. Coming up, we'll learn about a World War II-era diary written by a young Jewish woman that goes on display this week at the Jewish Museum, Milwaukee. That's coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a diary from a young Jewish girl was found in 1945 at the liberation of Auschwitz. Now it goes on display in the United States for the first time in Milwaukee at an exhibit that opens this week. We'll learn more about the diary, its author, and the light it shines on the history of the Holocaust. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about school lunches.
There's a high school in southwest Wisconsin where some of the food served in the cafeteria was raised and grown by the students themselves. Liz Domes takes us to Holman to meet the students producing meat and vegetables for their classmates.
It's just before 11, and the lunch ladies at Holman High School have about 15 minutes before the first wave of students floods the cafeteria. It's a race against the clock as they meander the tight corners of the kitchen to get the food where it needs to be, from stationary ovens to warming stations and eventually the buffet. On this particular day, Italian sausage is on the menu. It's made from pigs raised by students in the school's FFA, or Future Farmers of America program.
So when they come in, they're very excited when they see that we have, like, the pork today will be on the line, and you'll have multiple students who are very excited that their pork is here, and that was raised at my house, and, you know, so that's, it's very exciting and neat for them to see that.
That's Sarah Mum, the nutrition team leader at Holman High School. She's in charge of the cafeteria where more than 800 students will pass through the lunch line. The school's Viking Cafe also serves fruit and vegetables that were grown by FFA students. They raise asparagus and corn, watermelon with donated seeds, plus squash, potatoes, radishes, spinach, and lettuce. That matters, says FFA student and senior Daniel Beskramski, because of the connections it builds.
A lot of people are disconnected from where their food actually comes from. And because of that disconnection, some people can get a misconception about what actually happens with the food. How does it go from being grown to their plate?
It also builds connections between the person eating the food and the farmer who grew it. That's according to another FFA student, Avery Bailey. She says it corrects misconceptions about what the farmers are doing and why.
It helps to clear that up, being able to talk to another farmer or, you know, a student who grew your food, who put in the time to make sure that what you're getting was grown the right way.
About 90% of the students at Holman High School eat from the cafeteria. Students like junior Gracie Kromke say that's because the food is so good. She jokes about school lunch horror stories like rubberoni and slapping food on plates. She says that hasn't exactly been her experience at Holman.
I think knowing where food is coming from is always a huge proponent. People encourages people to buy the school lunches because they know where it's coming from. They know it's healthy and locally grown as well.
In this case, locally means just down the hallway. That's where we find senior Lydia Lipinski. She's standing in the school's new greenhouse. Lipinski open-enrolled to Holman specifically for its FFA program.
I kind of got to grow with the greenhouse, so seeing it from last year to now, looking at all the different plants, you go in there, it's all green, it's bright, it's pretty.
FFA students had been learning in a smaller space with skylights that drew in natural sunlight. But their new, bigger space has all the makings of a high-tech production. This has allowed them to grow more fruits and vegetables. Farm-to-school programs work to bring more locally grown products into schools. Best Kramski says exposure to fresh ingredients encourages other students to ask questions about their food. He'd love to see that knowledge spread elsewhere.
I really wish that other schools could do something like this, because it would just help with education as a whole, knowing, hey, this is where our food comes from.
Until then, these FFA students may be the foremost experts in telling the difference between spinach, lettuce, and kale.
WPR's Liz Domes brought us that story on Holman High School. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, at the liberation of Auschwitz in 1945, a Soviet doctor found a diary in the rubble written by a prisoner. The diary was kept in an attic for years. When it was discovered, historians found that the pages contained a first-hand account of life in the Łódź ghetto in Poland from the perspective of a young Jewish woman named Rivka Lipschitz. Now, in partnership with the Galicia Jewish Museum in Krakow, Poland, the diary will be displayed at the Jewish Museum in Milwaukee. The exhibit is called The Girl in the Diary, Searching for Rivka from the Łódź Ghetto. Museum curator Molly Dubin spoke with Central Time producer J. Carlisle Larson about the diary.
Tell me really quickly about what people are going to see at this exhibit.
What people will see is a narrative that goes along with this incredible discovery, which was a school notebook that was discovered by a Soviet doctor after the liberation of Auschwitz-Birkenau. And it was basically taken, and nothing was done with it for the next generation until the granddaughter of this individual was looking through her grandmother's effects, stumbled upon this, realized the potential significance, and she had been visiting Europe, brought it back to San Francisco, brought it to the Jewish Children and Family Services there, where they went about authenticating it and then eventually translating it. And it turns out to be this incredible diary written by this young Orthodox Jewish girl named Rivka Lipschitz. So the exhibit itself talks a lot about the discovery, but the more interesting factor really is what happens after it's found. It goes really, it's in the dark, you know, for 60 plus years, and then comes to light in 2008 when it's brought to San Francisco and it's published in 2010. So we have this mystery, because what happens after the discovery is that what we thought was the definitive fate of Rivka, based on testimony of a couple of her surviving cousins, is not now definitively the case. There have been other documents that have come to light. And that's one of the fascinating things that we're really showing, is how research and archival material, which has become more available on an international level, and as more and more collections become digitized and we're able to share, all of a sudden these documents are coming to light, and it's providing this path for research that we didn't have before.
We have this diary, and it really is a window into a teenager's time in the Łódź ghetto. This was a kind of like a real economic powerhouse during World War II. What did we learn from her perspective about what was happening during her time in the Łódź ghetto?
Well, we really learn quite a bit. And one of the reasons that this is really so informative is that we do have diaries from a number of young individuals that survived or perished in the Holocaust, and somehow their writings were buried or passed along and then found later. But we don't have a lot of female voices. The closest we kind of course, can make that jump to Anne Frank, mm-hmm. that kind of comes to mind. But the majority are young male voices. So to have this young female voice, and to have a voice from a young Orthodox woman, is also really interesting, because in her diary, she not only records the day-to-day life in the Łódź ghetto during a period that we really didn't have previously a lot of documentation about, but she also is coming of age.
Sure.
Yeah. Against a backdrop of atrocity. And so you also see this very individual who's very challenged with trying to figure out their identity. She's becoming a teen. She's grappling with a lot of thoughts, a lot of moral and ethical issues, and then just things that you would expect day-to-day teenagers to be dealing with, thinking about who they might be in love with or who loves them, or, you know, their friendships or spats with other girls that, you know, she is in workshops with, or with her cousins that she's living with. And she also has a voice of maturity that is well beyond her years. Her education was disrupted by the war at the age of 11. She starts the diary right after her 14th birthday. And so to have this incredible voice that is honest, that is really searching, and is also grappling with so many issues, that everything that she can't voice, really, that she's afraid to say to others or that she might fear repercussions from, the diary gets all of that.
Yeah, I think that that is one of the powerful things about these firsthand accounts, is that many students do learn about the Holocaust in elementary school, maybe throughout their education. But having those windows into the day-to-day lives that people had in either a ghetto, maybe we find something from a camp. How do you find that translated in a museum exhibit, where people get to see the diary, get to read about the diary, but then also get context for what was going on?
Sure. Well, one of the things we are really do quite a bit of is telling stories, you know, and I think one of the things that is so helpful in communicating about, educating about the Holocaust, sometimes we get, you know, groups that come through and it's hard to even wrap your mind around you know, a number like 6 million and, you know, all the individual stories that we'll never know. So to get these stories that come through and give you a glimpse of these individuals and what their lives were like and how they are very similar to us, how we can see ourselves in them, is, I think, one of the most powerful things. So having Rivka tell her story, we're actually looking at a particular individual, her experiences, but also all the artifacts mm-hmm. tell a story themselves. You know, you mentioned that the Lodz Ghetto produced a lot of items. So several of the items that we have that are on loan from the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum are items that would have been made or used in the Lodz Ghetto, or that were found in the rubble at the Chelmno Killing Center, which also speak to the personal dimensions of the Holocaust. Probably one of the most difficult artifacts we have is a set of baby shoes that were made by children who were slave labor in the Lodz Ghetto. And here are these baby shoes. You're, just to imagine that there is a child who is in need of those in that setting. They're taking, you know, just the scraps of fabric that are left to make these. That's really difficult. We have a number of the Yellow Star badges, and we have the individual stories behind those badges, you know, that speak to those individuals' experiences. We have a brooch that was made in the Lodz Ghetto that someone, you know, would have worn, and it depicts the kind of entryway to the ghetto and the sign there. So these are all giving personal dimensions to the experiences, and that is just tremendous resource in being able to educate about the Holocaust.
That was Molly Dubin, curator of the Jewish Museum Milwaukee. She talked to Central Time producer Jay Carlisle Larson about an exhibit that opens this week that showcases the diary of a young Jewish woman. The diary was found at the liberation of Auschwitz. The exhibit opens Thursday. Coming up, we'll check out a new list of 100 great books by African-American women and the contributions they've made to American culture. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, Facebook played a big role in the 2016 elections. Their latest policy aims to crack down on misleading political information, except in ads and postings from political candidates themselves. Find out what changes are and are not on the way this election year. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, African-American women have been writing their stories, their history, and the world they see around them for longer than they've been free in this country. But their works don't always get the recognition as part of the history of American literature. A new list called the Zora Canon includes 100 of the greatest works by African-American women going back to 1859. Morgan Jerkins is the senior editor at Zora, Medium's online space for women of color, and a visiting assistant professor at Columbia University's School of the Arts. She's the author of This Will Be My Undoing, Living at the Intersection of Black, Female, and Feminist in White America. Her second book, Wandering in Strange Lands, A Daughter of the Great Migration, Reclaims Her Roots, is due out this year. Morgan led the team who put this list together. Morgan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Sandra Adele is the F.U. Bascom Professor in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison. She's the author of several books, including a memoir titled Confessions of a Slot Machine Queen and editor of the anthology Contemporary Plays by African-American Women, 10 Complete Plays. Sandra, thanks for joining us in the studio.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, this list, the Zora Canon and Medium's Magazine, are named for Zora Neale Hurston. So that's a great place to start. Morgan, can you talk a little bit about the importance of Zora Neale Hurston and why you're using her name and why she features so prominently in this list of 100 books?
Oh, man, I don't even know where to start. I mean, Zora Neale Hurston was just a multi-hyphenate type of artist. I mean, she did ethnography, anthropology. She wrote short stories. She documented folklore for people of the South. And she encompassed so many different things. And what I'm so thankful about is that Zora Neale Hurston has such a vibrant afterlife. You know, she was rediscovered for her works back in the 1970s by Alice Walker. And she had an unmarked grave at the time. And so it's wonderful to be in this sort of cultural moment where there are many Black women, including myself, who are existing in this space where we can give honor to those like her who came before us, thus Zora Magazine.
And Sandra, let's talk about the importance of doing a project like this. There have been all these African-American women authors. Can you talk about the importance of making sure we remember them and keep coming back to their work?
Well, first of all, Morgan, thank you so much for you and your team to put this together. For your book, This Will Be My Undoing, I enjoyed reading your essays. This is very important because, let me say that those of us who are scholars have been compiling lists and bibliographies for a long time, but they're in scholarly books and journals. This is a compilation, and it's very comprehensive. And the important thing for me and for those of us who are still looking for more works to add to our ongoing canon is that it's online. And so I think that after looking at what they've done here, I think what's very important is that people who are not African-Americanist can't keep saying they can't find work by Black, women authors, because here it is at their fingertips. And so I just see a great potential for this. And I'm happy that it's getting the attention that has gotten over the last couple of days or couple of weeks.
And Morgan, the author Caitlin Greenidge wrote an intro for this list. She mentioned a Toni Morrison quote where Morrison talks about African-American women being read for sociology or moral reason, the idea that this is the broccoli of our reading. This list is not just about important historical documents. These are good reads too, right?
Yes, of course. I think what we wanted to do for this particular type of project is that we wanted to show people that Black women can write about a range of things. They wrote about their ancestors. They wrote about activism. They also wrote about sex, and they also wrote about intergenerational trauma. And so, I mean, I want to argue that Black women's writings, the meat, the potatoes, the broccoli, the dessert, you know what I'm saying? And so I agree. It's like it's so comprehensive, and no one has an excuse anymore.
Yeah. And the other important thing is that it's fiction, nonfiction, as she mentioned, poetry and other documents. And that's another aspect of its comprehensiveness. So it's crossing, for those of us who work in African American studies, we are interdisciplinary. So for us, this is going to be useful in all of our different areas, in sociology, literature, the arts, and history.
Morgan, can you talk about the process that went into selecting this diverse group of works from just 100 works? It might have been tough to narrow it down.
Absolutely. I mean, I will say it didn't just come from the team. We had to have a village of people. So when I was given this responsibility to start this special package, I reached out to other women whose works I have admired for years. And I asked them, you know, can you tell me about the 20 books that really meant something to you? 20 books by African-American authors. And magically, they were able to fill in many gaps. For example, you know, usually when you see lists of books to read by authors in general, there may be a deficit in poetry. Mm-hmm. There may be a deficit in anthologies. And we didn't have that with this list. I mean, we had sociologist Dr. Tressie McMillan Codum, who provided so many scholarly works. Then we had Professor Imani Perry also brought in the plays and all of these different type of collections. And then you had like Jesmyn Ward, Malaika Adaro, Margot Jefferson, and Ayanna Mathis bringing all this fiction and nonfiction. And we had the Zora team, when we looked at the list, we narrowed it down because there was a lot of overlaps. Of course, you're going to have overlaps with, of course, like the Toni Morrisons, the Alice Walkers, the Zora Neale Hurstons, of course. And we made sure that there weren't any overlaps in that way with, you know, one person nominating the same book over and over. But also we wanted to make sure in terms of the decades that there were full in each decade. So we might have suggested a book in the 1920s. We might have suggested a book in the 1960s and 70s in tandem with the civil rights movement. And that's pretty much how we did it.
Talking to Morgan Jerkins, senior editor at Zora, and Sandra Adele from UW-Madison. We're looking at a new list from Zora, the top 100, the 100 great works by African-American authors, African-American women authors in the United States. I want to start naming names. We're not going to get to all 100 books. Sandra, I want to get your response. What are some that struck you from this list that you were excited to see there?
Well, just about everything that I like. What struck me were the things that I have not read. And that's very important. Also, they have another list. What is it called, Morgan? 10 writers, women writers that you...
Yes, the 10 black women writers to watch. Yep.
10 black women writers to watch. Yeah. And that's important to me because, you know, I teach regularly. I'm a literature professor. I teach literature regularly. And I find myself stopping at Toni Morrison. And it's like, okay, there is a post-Toni Morrison life, you know, and world. And so, for example, Jasmine Award is somebody some of my other younger colleagues have said, you need to read this. So there are things, and poetry. Morgan Jenkins has a collection of poems, right? Morgan title?
Oh, Morgan Parker. Morgan Parker.
Oh, no, Morgan Parker. I'm sorry. Morgan Parker. I got you mixed up there. I got you a poet
as
well. But those are some newer poets that I don't know. And so that's the other important part of this is that it's bringing, you know, we're well into the 21st century now. So who are the new writers? Who are the new, in all of the different genres? And for me, in the different areas, rather, for me, it's literature. So there are some names on that list that I will certainly be reading and adding to. My list of things that we teach. And keep in mind also, when we're teaching, we're creating the canon. The canon's always going to shift, or maybe we can call it the tradition of African-American women writers. So it's always going to shift. There's room for more things to be brought into the so-called canon, the tradition. And that's a good thing.
And Morgan, can you highlight some of the early, we just heard about some of the more recent ones. Can you highlight some of the earlier ones on your list that stand out to you?
Oh, man, The Red Record by Ida B. Wells. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, she was publishing in 1895 and talking about lynching and other sorts of racially terroristic acts towards Black people in the South. To be able to document that and remain alive, I mean, that stood out to me. And it actually got me a little bit emotional when I saw the list because I had never read the book. And I'll be honest, I hadn't heard of that book until someone brought it up. And it just shows me that there's always progress to be made. I also think about a lot of the, you know, other stories that I haven't read before, like Funny House of a Negro by Adrian Kennedy.
That's a play. That's a play. And it's a very abstract play.
Yeah. Yeah. Play. Or like Coming of Age in Mississippi by Ann Moody.
Right.
I mean, there's so much. And so when I saw everything, the list as a whole, but as well as with the GIFs or GIFs, whatever your pronunciation is, the art, it made me feel so full, and it made me humble because it taught me that, yeah, I read a lot, but there's always more to read about those who came before me and what that can say towards the future.
That's one of the important things, exciting things about doing this kind of archival and editorial work and bibliographic work. I was the volume editor of the Dictionary of 20th Century Culture, African American Culture volume, and it was a similar experience because I was digging. I worked in all of the areas of the arts, literature, of course, that's my specialty, but visual arts, poetry, dance, film, and some of these things required that I learn, I study. That's why I took the project on, and it was such an eye-opener. And I want to congratulate you for doing this, but it's also just, as you say, a personally rewarding thing to be able to start digging around and thinking, oh, I never knew that. I didn't know this, you know,
right.
and then grow with the work itself.
Right.
Talking to Sandra Adele from UW-Madison and Morgan Jerkins from the online magazine Zora. Zora put together a list of the 100 greatest works by African-American women. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are there authors or works you're hoping to see on the list or wondering if they are? Are you looking for a recommendation if you like a certain type of reading? There's probably something on the list because it covers a lot of ground. What impact have some of these works by African-American women had on you? Call 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about great novels and works of nonfiction, drama, poetry, and more by African-American women. Sandra Adell is with us, the F.U. Bascom Professor in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison, and Morgan Jerkins, Senior Editor at Zora, Medium's online space for women of color. Morgan led the team who put together the Zora Canon, a list of the 100 greatest works by African-American women. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your recommendations yourself, maybe. 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Well, I'm going to reveal something about my gender preferences. The authors I've read the most on the list are Octavia Butler and N.K. Mm-hmm. Jemisin. I think if N.K. Jemisin put out, you know, her grocery shopping list in book form, I'd probably read it. Morgan, can you talk about the importance of getting a variety of genres, even science fiction and fantasy, like I like to read?
Because to remind people that Black women write in all different types of genres, but also I wanted to speak to an industry problem. I mean, I have a lot of poet friends, and they tell me all the time, like every time there are these comprehensive lists, poetry is often in the gutter, figuratively speaking. It maybe you have one or two sprinkled in there, but that's it. So I definitely wanted to make sure that people saw that women, Black women write anthologies, poetry, plays, science fiction, children's book, all those sorts of things.
Sandra, you were nodding along
there. Yeah, she's absolutely right. Poetry and drama are the two areas in African American literary studies that it's still in its infancy in many ways. And so that was the other thing that was so exciting that, yeah, she did it. She put that on there. You know, we got plays on there. She mentioned, you mentioned Morgan, Adrienne Kennedy, Funny House of a mm-hmm. Negro. I mean, mm-hmm. This was a major a playwright of the 1960s, but we hear very little about her, but a lot about Amiri Baraka. Right? Mm-hmm. And so the things that I'm looking at on my schedule that I'm teaching, I'm starting with Frederick Douglass. I switch off between Frederick Douglass one semester and Harriet Jacobs another time. It depends. You know, I switch these different courses. This is for an intro to Masterpieces of African-American Literature. And one of the early things that I know the question's going to be asked about the first few books is where are the women, where they're coming. You know, I've got it set up kind of chronologically. And that's another thing that's important to get this list out to people like myself, who've been teaching for years, to kind of, again, you know, bring some variety into it. Young people like science fiction. I need to get into the science fiction more. You know, it's not my genre, but it's important to present this to them. And this is another thing. I can't keep stressing enough how important it is that this is an online list. That's where young people go. You know, to get their information, and it's major. Now, one thing I do want to say is that people usually ask me what is my favorite book. It's probably Song of Solomon by Toni Morrison. I've got many favorite books, but I keep going to it again and again. And this is one of those books where every time I read it, I find something new, and that's so exciting to me.
That's great. Well, do you have a favorite? I know it's hard to pick a favorite. Thank you for volunteering yours, Sandra. Morgan, do you have one that's like that that you keep going back to?
I mean, she kind of took it for Uh-oh. Me, Dr. Adell. I was going to say right. Song of Solomon, man. Yes. Like, I mean, I would say Beloved. I mean, there's just so many, but Song of Solomon is that that's the top, right? That's the cream of the crop.
All right. Now, Sandra, can you talk about, I know at many points in American history, that point may include today, it's harder for women sometimes to get published than men, harder for Black authors to get published than white authors. Can you talk about the challenges over the years of African-American women authors just getting their foot in the door and getting their works published?
That hasn't changed. It's very, very difficult. And I don't know how, I guess the only way to make those changes and make it easier is to get more women in those positions, editorial positions and decision-making positions in publishing. You know, it's a tricky thing, though, because, you know, most writers have difficult times, difficulty getting published. But it's, you know, particularly if we're writing about ourselves in our lives, it's like, oh, no, you know, no one's interested. You know, who's going to be interested in the lives of Black women? Alice Walker proved that people are very interested in the lives mm-hmm. of black women with the color mm-hmm. of purple, mm-hmm. which now you know is, has been a movie and sure. is now a touring musical.
Uh-huh. So it did okay.
It did okay. It did okay. But again, people forget about the labor that went into this. And, you know, Alice Walker was an editor for Ms. Magazine before she started publishing novels. And she was, as Morgan mentioned, she literally resurrected Zora Neale Hurston. And young people everywhere seem, especially with their eyes are watching God, they seem to be very attracted to that. So that's another thing about this list. People know the name Zora.
We heard from John in Appleton who wants to know if there's a plan to get more African-American authored books in libraries and community read projects. Morgan, do you see that as one possible use for your Zora list that, a librarian somewhere could take this and build a display or two around it?
Oh, we have some really exciting news and other developments coming soon. So stay tuned.
Okay, so that might be something, John, that actually happens in the near future. You teach classes about all these authors, Sandra. Do you see things going on in libraries and public schools? Beyond the bounds of a university.
I can't say much about public schools because I'm surprised. I don't know what young people are reading today. It's like, when is the last time you read a novel, period? But with what's happening in the libraries, we're very fortunate here in Madison. We've got great librarians. I mean, we can go into any of these libraries here and find books by and about African-American women. That's another thing that you pointed out, though, or was pointed out, that this list is going to be of great use to people in places like Appleton or some of these small rural communities that have small libraries and they don't have the resources to find the work, that's on that list. So this is going to help them.
Morgan, do you have you mentioned there are some developments in the works for the top 100 works by African-American women. But Sandra said earlier, we revisit the canon all the time. We come back. Are there plans to have more updated lists or more efforts to feature more current and contemporary authors?
I think that's something that we're definitely considering because as I noted in or the team has noted in the intro to the canon is that this is not 100% comprehensive. It's not 100% definitive. There are so many other works out there that we are discovering and rediscovering. So I think this needs to be a continuing conversation in the world of arts and letters and just in our respective communities.
And as we start to wrap up, Sandra, I think there was a time where we heard the phrase the great American novel, and it was usually by a guy, it was usually by a white guy about white people. Can you talk about the importance of considering other people as part of the American story and literature?
I think it's happening. This is one aspect. But we have to think of people of color, period, women of color, period. And it's going on. This is ongoing. Things are changing, but at the university level, the problem is what's happening in high schools or in community colleges. What are they reading? I don't know. That's the issue. And that's maybe something, I don't know if Morgan wants to take that on, but something that somebody else needs to look at. How can we change and affect the reading list of young people? By the way, one other thing to mention is that she's got stories by young adult stories on that list too. That's important.
Oh, do you want to hit us with a YA one from the list in our last few moments, Morgan?
Oh man, I'm looking at the list right now because I'm trying to remember all of them.
I saw one.
Yeah, there was one, and I'm just trying to look at it. But I've had to come back to that.
Oh, that's okay. Well, I'll point people toward, if you look up Zora, that's Z-O-R-A, Canon, C-A-N-O-N, you will find that, or it's at the Zora website. You can check out the whole list there. Some great reading fun for us to look forward to. And that's all the time we have, Morgan. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And Sandra, thanks a lot for coming up today.
Thank you.
We had Sandra Adele in the studio with us, the F.U. Bascom professor in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison, editor of the anthology Contemporary Plays by African-American Women, 10 Complete Plays. And Morgan Jerkins was with us, senior editor of the online magazine Zora. Again, a link to that Zora canon list, by the way, you can find that at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, Virginia passed the Equal Rights Amendment this month, way after the deadline for constitutional ratification. We'll look at the rise and fall of the ERA and why it's in the headlines again. And we'll check out a Wisconsin project that's following the sounds of life in forests around the planet, and we'll give a listen ourselves. That and more tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, hear the story of a Wisconsin woman who has become one of the best triathletes in the entire world. That's tomorrow at 6 on the morning show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we talk about Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy of criticizing polite racism among white liberals and saying that even in his time, people paid more attention to what was happening in the South, not paying enough attention to the North and the Midwest. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.